to work from home, even if you have a private study, it's not always so easy. So anyway, we're having a lot of fun this semester. There's a lot of great discussion, a lot of great questions, and I certainly enjoy this topic or these topics that we're talking about, and I can tell that you guys do too. So without further ado, why don't I go ahead and start recording, and then we can have our official office hour session. February the 4th, and delighted to be with all of you guys today and ready to talk about our course, to answer any questions that you have about the material that we've been reading or about anything whatsoever. So as we've done before, I think we ought to start out the session focusing on issues and topics and questions and readings that are most directly related to our course. But if we run out of those, I think we ought to talk about anything that you guys want. Hopefully related to economics or management or business or technology, but if you want to talk about the weather or situation in Egypt or anything else, I think it would be fun to talk about those things too. So who wants to jump in with the first question? I'm going to double check that I have all my readings in front of me. Let's see here. Okay, so the article on path dependence by Doug Puffert was, he goes into a little bit more detail about the railroad gauge example, than we did in our discussions. That article, as you may have noticed, was written for an encyclopedia. It's the EHNet Encyclopedia of Economic History. Now, one of the things that you should notice is that the concept of path dependence, as it builds on the literature and network externalities, is extremely important for historians, right? Most of our discussions have been about path dependence and lock-in, in sort of shorter periods of history, from 1980 to 2000, or, from 2005 to the present, or something like that. But economic historians, and historians more generally, have been very interested in this. Going much farther back in history, if you think about a lot of institutions, legal systems, language, the things that we talked about last time, political institutions and so on, it's very difficult to change existing institutions, even if people believe that some feasible alternative would be better, right? Because the transition costs are very high. That's what we're seeing in Egypt right now. So there are some people who might argue that Mubarak has to go, the Mubarak regime is awful, et cetera, but that the transition period would also be very difficult. And people have made the argument, I personally don't find it very convincing, but people have made the argument that given the problems that would ensue from the transition, especially a transition that isn't peaceful, it's better for someone like Mubarak to stay in power, at least for the short term, than it is for someone like that to leave. Again, in that particular case, I'm not convinced that the transition costs are as high as they're made out to be, but you could certainly imagine a case like that, right, where the status quo is better than the alternative once you take into account the cost of changing. That's what Oliver Williamson calls the criterion of remediableness. Remember, we talked about that on Wednesday. If a problem isn't remediable, meaning it isn't fixable, then maybe you're better off with what you got. And, historians looking back at political structures and international relations, all aspects of the institutional environment, have been very drawn to this concept of path dependence. And the literature on network effects and network externalities has provided kind of a nice theoretical framing for these historians to use in trying to explain things, you know, change or slow change over a long period of time. Anyway, so that's a roundabout way of saying I realize that that article from EHNet is, you know, again, this goes into more detail about certain things that we're not as interested in our course, but especially the beginning part of the article explaining the QWERTY case, going over path dependence and Lockean in general, I think is very good. It's a very good exposition, and it's sort of spot on for the kinds of things that we're studying here. If you're particularly interested in the QWERTY story, you might look at the original article by Leibowitz and Margolis called The Fable of the Keys that's mentioned in the other two readings for this week. At least you can find the reference there. And you can get it for free on Stan Leibowitz's webpage. If you didn't recognize that the title of that article, The Fable of the Keys, is sort of a play on words. There's a very famous piece by Bernard Mandeville in the 18th century called The Fable of the Bees, very important work in economics on the division of labor. And Leibowitz and Margolis cleverly picked up on that title to come up with their Fable of the Keys, which, you know, is it's one of those things I wish I'd thought of it. It's very clever. Okay, got some questions coming in. Maggie, do you think there should be any laws to control or manage the internet? Are any necessary due to the voluntary participation required in using it? Well, that's a really good question. And the short answer is, let's wait until next week because we have a whole session. Sorry. Well, the next 2 weeks, actually. Next week on the internet and then the week after on political, you know, public policy issues more generally. But maybe, Maggie, it would be useful at this point, you know, just to distinguish between, you know, call it governance, G-O-V-E-R-N-A-N-C-E, and government, right? In public, you know, in a lot of discourse, government and governance are taken as synonyms. So when people say we need planning, we need control, we need et cetera, et cetera, they typically mean we need the state authorities to do that planning and control. Both Mises and Hayek referred on different occasions to this sort of confusion over the use of the word planning. And Hayek, the way Hayek expressed it, writing about socialism, he said everyone agrees that there needs to be planning in an economy. The question is who should do the planning? Is it individuals, firms, families, voluntary associations, or is it the state? Right? Now that's a roundabout way of saying, you know, do we need governance mechanisms for the internet? You know, simplest example being kind of the technical standards, right? All, you know, routers and servers that are hooked up to the internet need to speak a common language. They need to know how to translate IP addresses, you know, domain names into IP addresses to find particular servers on the network. They need, you know, the HTTP protocol, you know, email protocols and so on to be able to interact. Now, those are rules. Right? Those are forms of governance. The question is, do we need the coercive authority of the state to set those up, or can we rely on, you know, kind of the bottom-up spontaneous order, to use Hayek's term, you know, of the market to come up with those rules and standards on their own? And I remember someone brought up in the discussion on Wednesday, you know, the various technical protocols like the USB format, right? I mean, how big is the little plug that fits in the USB port, and how many, you know, what voltage will it carry, and, you know, so on and so forth. There needs to be some standardization of those for something like USB, you know, to work. But you don't necessarily need state planners to do it. So, I mean, I guess at this point I would say I think it's very hard to come up with reasons why private authorities cannot come up with appropriate guidelines, even restrictions, for things like content, right? Now, this goes into the subject of net neutrality, which we'll talk about quite a bit in week five. But, you know, is it, I mean, think about your television, right? If you have a modern TV set, it probably has parental controls built into it. Parents can set it up with a password or whatever, so that, you know, kids can only watch certain channels or certain shows with the parents' permission. I mean, that's a sort of a simple example, even a trivial one, but an example of kind of voluntary mechanisms to regulate content. So you hear legislators and regulators talk about, you know, protecting kids from harmful stuff on the internet, you know, keeping terrorists from getting their information on, being able to spread their information. You know, if you task the state authorities with the responsibility of exercising that kind of control, yeah, it's a very tricky thing. That's certainly letting a genie out of the bottle. You could have cases like we've seen in the last few days where, you know, the Egyptian authorities, the Egyptian state police might say, well, allowing Twitter users to tweet, hey, we're going to have a demonstration in such and such a square on this day at this time, bring your signs. The Egyptian state police might say, well, that's, you know, that's plotting terrorism. That's treason. And so, of course, the state planners should have the authority to shut that off, to block that application, or, you know, to shut the whole internet down or whatever. Whereas most of us would think, no, that doesn't seem like a very legitimate use of the police power. So, you know, you give government authorities the ability and the kind of, you know, sanction to exercise this kind of control, and it can be a very difficult thing. But by the way, one other point is, you know, one can make a case for sort of alternative competing standard-setting bodies and ways of exercising control, so you don't centralize it in the hand of one kind of monopoly provider. So you might have lots of different entities that, you know, do ratings, that do filtering, content checking, and so on, and allowing those to compete in the marketplace, you know, might lead to better ones than, you know, than you would get if you have just one monopoly provider. Okay, Maggie, let me know if that's not kind of what you're getting at. Jeff has a question. Do you think the emergence of money demonstrates network effects? Yes, I certainly do. While also showing that the market can find the most efficient outcome. Yeah, I mean, this kind of goes back to the historical discussion, you know, with Leibowitz and Margolis and so on, looking at typewriter keyboards. I mean, we do have lots of examples in history of standards being chosen by the market, money being one example, the typewriter layout being another example. Now, even if we concede that network effects are present in those cases, as I think they are, and that there is the possibility of one of these kind of random butterfly effects, you know, leading us to be locked in to an inefficient standard, we then want to ask, well, A, you know, has that actually happened historically? Do we have good evidence that the market is choosing standards that ex post appear to be relatively inefficient? If so, is there anything that could have been done about it, and so on? Well, Leibowitz and Margolis are arguing in part, I mean, partly they're criticizing the theory of Paul David and Brian Arthur, but they're also criticizing the empirical record and saying, look, QWERTY is really not that bad compared to the alternatives that are feasible. Most of the ergonomic studies indicate that QWERTY is, you know, just about as good as any other layout. Any typing layout is pretty much as good as any other in terms of typing speed. Really, the only differences are, you know, how long it takes you to learn one. But a fast typist can do just as well on QWERTY as they can do on Dvorak once they've learned how to do it. Jeff brings up a great example of money, right? You know, in a pure kind of network effects kind of story, one could imagine that, you know, any commodity could potentially be chosen as money, right? Parties randomly start using one particular commodity. You know, maybe we want to restrict the set of feasible commodities, you know, to some smaller set. I mean, you know, butter wouldn't be a good medium of exchange because you want a good medium of exchange to have certain physical properties, you know, durability, you know, high value to weight, something that's divisible, that's transportable, and so on, is available in, you know, small units, can be used for small transactions, and so on. Okay, so maybe we start with 15 commodities that could conceivably work. You could tell a story in which, just at random, one gets chosen. And the one gets chosen might not be any better than the ones that didn't get chosen. It just was some random event that gave it a little head start. Well, even if we think that's theoretically possible, you know, we look at the historical record, and you know, the commodities that have been chosen in most of the cases that we know tend to have had some pretty desirable properties relative to the alternatives that were available at that time and in that place, right? You know, in most societies, the commodities that have tended to be chosen ultimately are precious metals, gold and silver. And if we think about it theoretically, they do have the best properties. You know, they do seem to be the best commodities of those that could have been chosen, right? Gold and silver are rare, so they have a high ratio of value to weight. They're durable. They can be divided up, melted down, made into coins, into bars, and so on. They're highly durable, easily recognizable, and so on, right? I mean, gold and silver, you know, it's not just an accident that they've tended to be chosen in almost all the cases that we know. They really are good as money. However, look at a few other exceptions. I mean, we talked about seashells, right? But it wasn't, you know, seashells in Bavaria or seashells in, you know, Iowa that got chosen. Right, the places where things like seashells have been used have typically been small island societies. Polynesia, for example, where seashells were sufficiently abundant to be useful as money, but yet rare enough, or certain types rare enough, that they weren't easily copied, that they did have a reasonable ratio of value to weight. You can carry them in your pocket and so on. You know, places... you know, in Africa, for example, where precious metals were extremely rare, difficult to come by, or the technology to shape them into bars and coins and so on did not exist, or there weren't seashells. You know, livestock, we sort of laugh at it and think, you know, well, how primitive can you be? Well, you can imagine a historical setting where using livestock as commodities, as commodity money, is not bad. My friend Larry White used to put it, you know, one great advantage of using livestock as money is that your money can carry itself to market. But there is a drawback that it's difficult to make change. So, you know, certainly the emergence of money is an example where, you know, strong network effects lead to a kind of path dependence. But it seems that market participants have done pretty good at overcoming those problems and choosing standards that seem to make a lot of sense. And of course, when governments later in history tried to monopolize, and in most cases successfully monopolized, the production and control of commodity money, and then introduced their own fiat paper money on top of it, you know, they didn't just choose random commodities. They chose the commodities that the market had already selected as money. Okay, Maggie says, I'm also taking a Zealous course. Uh-oh, so now I'm in trouble now. This is the course on Introduction to Libertarian Theory. Is that right, Maggie? I think that's the course. It's not the IP course, right? It's the Libertarian course. I'm curious about how ideas of aggression would translate to the Internet. Yeah, Libertarian Legal Theory, thank you. Do you think you could or should ever prosecute someone who aggressed against someone else online? Would aggression be limited to theft and fraud? That's an interesting question. We might talk about that a little bit on two class periods from now. I don't know that I had thought about covering it in exactly that way. I mean, look, I think a simpler example would involve fax machines. Let's use an example involving fax machines. So let's say that we have some notion of what constitutes, you know, a violation of somebody's rights. If we begin, as most libertarian legal theories do, with some notion of property rights, then, you know, breaking into my home and stealing my dog, you know, represents a pretty clear property rights violation. You know, beating me up, harming my person, represents a violation of my rights. you know, smashing my fax machine with a hammer would represent a violation of my rights. Now, what about sending me an unsolicited fax? Well, it's a little bit tricky, right? I mean, there has to be some kind of contractual relationship between the owner of the fax machine and the paper and the toner, which is used and depleted and you know, there's some wear and tear. What's the relationship between that owner, the owner of those things, and the person who sent the fax, right? So, you know, in most libertarian legal approaches, you know, you have rights to person and property, but you don't have rights to everything, right? So, if my neighbor, you know, let's say I'm a wine snob and my neighbor isn't and drinks crappy wine, and it really bothers me that anybody could drink that horrible wine, and it just gets under my skin, it gets on my nerves that my neighbor is in there drinking that, you know, crappy wine. Well, obviously that isn't a violation of my rights. I mean, it may bother me, it may irk me, it may get under my skin, but my rights have not been violated, right? Likewise, somebody watching TV or somebody looking at a website that I don't approve of, you know, again, that may, morally, there may be an issue for me, but it isn't a violation of my legal rights. What about somebody sending me a fax? Well, I think here we want to look ultimately at the, you know, the things that can be owned, things that are ownable, tangible things over which contracts can be written. So, you know, what sometimes gets overlooked in those stories is the contractual relationship between me, the owner of the fax machine, and the owner of the telephone line or the data line that is connected to my fax. So I have some legal contractual relationship with the party that runs the wire to my house and sticks the wire into my machine. Who has control over that content? Do I have the legal right to block certain kinds of content? Most people would say, look, if you had a fax machine that you could set up to only accept faxes from certain numbers that you put on a list, a white list, well, that wouldn't be a violation of the rights of somebody who isn't on that list who wants to send you a fax, right? Maybe I can write a contract with my provider to say, you know, I only want these kinds of faxes to come in and I don't want these other kinds of faxes to come in. Or maybe I have a contract with my provider that says, anybody who wants to send me a fax can do it. Any fax data that comes into my home, you know, is going to go right to my machine and it's going to use some of my ink and some of my paper to print that thing out. In other words, it's up to the market to decide what's the relationship between the data provider and the fax machine owner. And then the data provider would have a contractual relationship with parties that are sending the data, initiating the data, and so on. So looked at that way, it isn't obvious, you know, there's no sort of obvious ex ante, you know, case for allowing all faxes to come through or banning certain kinds of faxes. I mean, it's up to these market participants to, you know, to come up with rules and practices that they want. They can negotiate, they can agree, they can contract. Now, essentially, it's no different when we go to the web and the internet, right? It's easier to see in the fax machine case because there's a real cost to my receiving an unsolicited fax. It's not as obvious, you know, spam email. It's not an obvious physical cost. I mean, I guess there's some wear and tear on my computer, on my disk drive, on my monitor, and so on, but it's pretty negligible, you know, in the case of a particular email. And I would say the same kind of rules apply, right? In a pure sort of free market setting where everything is privately owned, my computer is privately owned, the network cables are privately owned, the satellite equipment or the fiber or whatever it is that comes into my house and connects me to the next internet node, that's all privately owned. The routers and switches are privately owned, you know, all the way down to the, you know, all the way through the entire system, right? There wouldn't be an obvious case to me for having government restrictions on, you know, who can send what emails to whom based on violation of property rights, right? It's not obvious to me how you could aggress. Well, the only way you could commit an act of aggression in a case like that would be, you know, physically to harm someone else's property or to violate the terms of a contract that you've written, right? So if I agree, you know, not to run a you know, peer-to-peer file sharing server on my home computer, that's, it's in the contract with my internet service provider, and that I will not run a BitTorrent server, and I do, well then, I mean, my provider, my ISP, would have a legal claim to collect damages from me or to get a libertarian court to enjoin my, you know, my activities or whatever. But, you know, aside from that, it's not clear what would constitute aggression, because the only sort of, you know, natural rights that you have in a case like that are the rights to the security of your person and property and the right to enforce contracts that you've signed. Other than that, it's not obvious what would constitute, you know, a rights violation. I don't know, do you have something specific in mind, Maggie, besides that? I mean, look, we all get ticked off when we get spam and junk mail. You know, one way to think about it is think about, you know, sort of legal versus technological solutions to these problems. And, you know, spam's a pain, but, you know, smart filtering and so on can make it not so bad. Some of you remember, you know, even, I don't know, 5 years ago, more primitive web browsers, you know, you could get pop-up windows all over the place. It was much easier for your browser to be hijacked and so on. Well, I mean, browser technology has improved. Security technology has improved to make those things less of a problem. So, you know, any time there are sort of internet phenomena that are not necessarily legal rights violations, but are things that people don't like, junk mail and spam and adware and so on, you know, well, that provides an incentive for entrepreneurs, right, to come up with technologies to improve the situation. And again, that's no different from, you know, any kind of setting, even before the internet. You know, better insulation for noise pollution, you know, fences, monitors and cameras and so on. Actually, one of the most important technological innovations for eliminating externality problems in the development of the American West is barbed wire. The invention of barbed wire, you know, it's extremely important for the development of the American West. I mean, putting up fences solves a lot of conflicts among property owners, and the entrepreneurs who invented barbed wire and deployed barbed wire and produced barbed wire made a lot of money doing it. Okay, Matthew has a question about risk and uncertainty. Matthew says in a chapter in your book, and he's referring to my book that came out last year, published by the Mises Institute, called The Capitalist and the Entrepreneur, Essays on Organizations and Markets, which you can find at all of the, is available at all the finest bookstores, including the Mises Institute online store, and you can even read the whole book for free online in PDF. If you don't care about, you know, my royalties and my ability to send my kids to college, then go ahead and download the free version. No, I'm just kidding. I actually don't make any royalties off the sale of the book. Matthew says, in a chapter in that book, you discussed the differences between risk and uncertainty. I'll elaborate on that for just a moment, for the, just in case any of you haven't read the book, though I would find that absolutely shocking. It seems quite obvious that most human action and market processes involve uncertainty rather than risk. Many economists don't seem to emphasize this distinction. Excuse me, why would you say that is? Is it because accepting uncertainty does not allow for the possibility of modeling economic phenomena in any predictive manner? Yeah, Matthew, I think you hit the nail right on the head. I think that's exactly the main reason. To back up, for those of you who aren't as familiar with this distinction, the terms, the way most people think of the distinction between risk and uncertainty It goes back to the economist Frank Knight, whose famous 1921 book is called Risk, Uncertainty, and Profit, where he elaborates on this distinction in great detail. Essentially, what Knight has in mind is, you know, two kinds of scenarios where we don't know the future. One is spinning a roulette wheel, right? So imagine a roulette wheel. I don't say it's 32 numbers that could come up, and it's a fair, you know, it's not a biased wheel, it's not rigged. When you spin the wheel, you don't know what number will come up, but you know that there are 32 possible outcomes. Each one has a probability of 1 over 32, right? And you can estimate the probability of any one number coming up, right? Rolling a die would be the same way. Those are cases where we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we have a pretty well-specified notion of what the problem is. We know all the possible outcomes. We can assign probability weights to each outcome. We can calculate an expected value, the likelihood that any one particular outcome will arise. And we can do some, you know, sort of straightforward economic planning. I can decide how much I want to invest. How much do I want to put on this number? How much do I want to bet on this number, given the probability of winning and how much I would win if I do win, and so on. Knight described those cases. He used the term risk to describe cases like that. Ludwig von Mises used the term class probability, meaning we don't know exactly what event will occur, but all of the events are part of a homogeneous class of events. These are what are sometimes described as insurable risks. You can buy insurance against one number coming up or not coming up. You can buy insurance against your house burning down, because we have a pretty good idea of the probability that any particular house in a particular neighborhood of a particular type will burn down in a particular day. Other situations, which what Knight called uncertainty, are those in which, you know, we don't even know what's the set of things that could possibly happen, much less the likelihood that any one particular thing will happen. So there's no way we can write down a mathematical function with probability weights to calculate the expected value of this thing happening, right? The world of entrepreneurship is a world of uncertainty rather than risk, right? What's the probability that a given internet startup company will be successful? Well, we can't calculate that in a mathematical sense and apply a number to it, right? The entrepreneur who starts that company has some kind of a sense, an intuitive understanding, a set of beliefs about what might happen in the future. But that's a very different kind of a problem from spinning a wheel or rolling a die. Okay, so those are cases of uncertainty rather than risk. And in the book that Matthew's referring to, I discuss how Knight's and Mises' theory of uncertainty helps us to understand profit and loss in the market economy and helps us understand entrepreneurship in the firm. And what entrepreneurs essentially do is bear uncertainty rather than probabilistic risk. Risk you can write contracts for in insurance markets and so on. For uncertainty, the only way really to take advantage of uncertainty, to put one's ideas into practice in a world of uncertainty, is by being an entrepreneur and creating a firm and having skin in the game and so on. Matthew's question is why mainstream economists prefer to think in terms of risk rather than uncertainty. I think part of it is a methodological concern, as Matthew has suggested, that, you know, we know how to model risk in terms of equations. We don't know how to model uncertainty in a formal way. Those of you who have taken some of you may have taken a course, maybe in an economics course, if you had a game theory course or decision theory course, where you draw these little diagrams, it looks like a little tree, right? And at the top of the tree, you have to decide, should I take my umbrella or not? Well, if I take my umbrella, I go down this node of the tree, I have to carry it around, I might lose it. If I leave my umbrella at home, going down this end of the tree, well, I don't have as much stuff to carry, but then it might rain. And so at the end of each of those nodes, there's another little tree. You know, will it rain? Yes, no. Will it rain? Yes, no. If I have my umbrella and it rains, I'm happy. If I have my umbrella and it's not raining, I'm annoyed because I have to carry around an umbrella I don't need on the other side of the tree, right? If it rains and I don't have my umbrella, I'm very unhappy. If it rains and I do have my umbrella, I'm happy. So what should I do? Well, it depends on the probability of rain. If it's 90% likely that it's going to rain, then it's pretty obvious that the highest valued action is to take my umbrella. If it's highly unlikely that it's not going to rain, the highest valued action is to leave my umbrella at home. What if the probability of rain is 50-50? Well, then it depends on, you know, how bad is it to be caught out in the rain without an umbrella versus how bad is it to be lugging an umbrella around all day that you don't need. But if you can have numbers for, you know, how good or bad each outcome is, and you have a mathematical probability for the likelihood of rain, a percentage, you can just multiply everything out. And you can work backwards and easily compute the optimal action to take when you're leaving your house that morning. That's a highly parameterizable problem, I guess you'd say. It's tractable. It's easy to write down. It's easy to solve. It's usable in mathematical formulations of decision making and so on. Uncertainty you can't model formally in that way. And so you can't treat it with the same set of tools. There's a good quotation from Theodore Schultz. I think I have it in the book, but I'll have to go back and look. Sort of expressing why, in Schultz's view, there are two ways of acting when you don't know the future. There's decision making under risk, where you have probabilities, and we model decision makers as acting that way. And there's random action. Blind luck, right? Either you played the probabilities right and you got the expected value that you wanted, or you just got lucky. There's nothing in between. What I think Knight and Mises have in mind is a kind of understanding of the future that is not purely mechanical and formalistic, but is also not just blind luck. It's somewhere in the middle. Austrians often use the German term Verstehen, which is translated as understanding, but in the German it's deeper, and it's not a perfect translation. It's kind of a deep knowledge that you can't easily articulate and write down in a formula, but yet that you still have in your head. It's a kind of tacit understanding about the future, and in Mises and Knight's and my conception of the entrepreneur, entrepreneurs possess this kind of understanding, and it's based on a kind of uncertainty, or what Mises calls case probability, rather than risk, or what Mises calls class probability. It wasn't off topic, Matthew. I think it's important, and I'm sure we can find other ways to kind of tie that in to discussions that we're having specifically on kind of network issues. I mean, one thing you might say right now is that some of the in Leibowitz and Margolis, in Puffert's article, they have some numerical illustrations of what different types of path dependence would look like, and what are the increasing returns from adopting a particular standard or whatever. Now, those numerical examples serve very well as illustrations, right? Something like Moore's law or Metcalfe's law that we can write down in numbers in formulas. Again, it serves as a useful kind of exposition, but it isn't the case that theories of network effects and the adoption of standards, Hayek's notion of spontaneous order, it isn't the case that it must be specified formally in equations to have any validity or meaning. So, I mean, sometimes you can use numbers and equations to illustrate those concepts, but I think Menger's treatment in his article on money, Hayek's treatment in his many writings on emergent orders and so on, while expressed purely verbally, are just as good as other formulations that are expressed mathematically. Okay. Hey, Jeff has a question about socialism and socialist calculation. Okay, Jeff is asking a very good question about differences between Mises and Hayek's understandings of the socialist calculation problem, right? So, as Jeff points out correctly, you know, Mises describes the problem in terms of lack of private ownership of property. Hayek describes it in terms of problems of dispersed tacit knowledge, centralization or decentralization of knowledge. I haven't had enough coffee this morning. Are these different? Are they alternatives? Are they different ways of expressing the same thing? I mean, this is, I guess, kind of a big can of worms to be open, and I think it's fine to open it. There's been a lot of discussion, debate, and I would say controversy in Austrian circles in the last 10, 15 years about the relationship between Mises and Hayek on the calculation, on this problem of socialist economic calculation. Joe Salerno wrote some articles in the early 90s, one article in 1990 called Ludwig von Mises as Social Rationalist, and then another article in 1993 called Mises and Hayek Dehomogenized, in which he argued that there were important differences between the way Mises understood the calculation problem and the way Hayek understood it. There were several other articles that were written by people like Leland Yeager, even Israel Kirzner, arguing that no, Mises and Hayek, though they express the problem in slightly different language, are really offering complementary arguments. There's no tension between Mises' view and Hayek's view on this problem. It would take too long for us to work through all of the nuances and subtleties and ambiguities of this debate. My own view is that there are important differences between Mises and Hayek's ways of putting the problem. They're not superficial differences. It's not just differences of language or exposition. But where I think the debate has gotten messy and the waters have gotten too muddy is people in the debate focusing too heavily on the socialist calculation problem alone in isolation. I think what Joe Salerno is really offering in his articles in the 90s is really a radical reinterpretation of what Austrian microeconomics is all about in the first place, right? If you look at the video series that Salerno and I did called Fundamentals of Economic Analysis, A Causal Realist Perspective. Also, if you look at my article in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics called The Mundane Economics of the Austrian School, excuse me, I'm building heavily in that article on Salerno's arguments, essentially saying that, look, there are important differences between Mises and Hayek, not just on socialism, but more broadly on their understandings of what the market is, how the market works, what are exchanges and pricing and so on. So I argue that there are different sort of flavors of Austrian microeconomics, Austrian price theory, both flavors or all flavors, legitimately having their roots in Menger. But look, if you read Guido Hulsmann's Mises biography, which is a magnificent magisterial treatment of the history of the Austrian school, you see that right from the beginning, Menger's ideas were taken in two very different directions by Menger's pupils, Eugen von Bombawerk and Friedrich von Wieser. So Wieser and Bombawerk, both founding figures in the Austrian school, had very different understandings of the sort of the basics of markets and pricing. Wieser's thought was elaborated on and developed by Hayek. Wieser, not Mises, was Hayek's thesis supervisor and major professor. Bombawerk's ideas were developed by Mises. And so you had kind of two different traditions or two different branches of the Austrian school with different arguments about what it is that entrepreneurs do, how it is that markets work. I think that the Menger, Wieser, Hayek, Kirzner branch in some ways is closer to the mainstream notions of equilibrium and pricing. There's a strong influence from kind of the mainstream Valrasian tradition in that particular strand. And I think that if you look at, if you go Menger, Bombavert, Mises, Rothbard, Salerno, you have a slightly different tradition that is more separated from the mainstream Valrasian approach in terms of what it means, what equilibrium is all about, what it is that entrepreneurs do, what kinds of price signals are important, and so on. At this point, I'll just say, look at some of these early Salerno papers. You can look at my mundane Austrian economics article. Look at the video series by Salerno and myself to get some more background here. I think for many of the problems that we study within the Austrian tradition, these differences are, they don't really matter. They're sufficiently subtle and nuanced that, whether one takes the Hayek approach or the Mises approach, it doesn't really matter. I think there are other issues where it might. And there are applied issues in monetary policy, for example, where I think the differences between the Mises and Hayek approach might be important. That's a roundabout way of saying I don't really want to get into it too much because it's complicated and it gets kind of messy. Danny has a question about profit management versus bureaucratic management. And thanks, guys, for the links to the Salerno thing that I was mentioning. So we've been talking about private entrepreneurs and profit, what Mises calls profit management, namely entrepreneurs who are purchasing factors of production and deploying them under conditions of uncertainty in anticipation of monetary gain, material financial gain. What about those who are pursuing objectives that are not measurable in terms of money? So we don't necessarily mean government agencies. What about so-called social entrepreneurs? What about charities? What about philanthropic ventures? What about nonprofits? What can we say about how they are kind of owned, governed, and managed? Well, Danny's referring to Mises' 1944 book, Bureaucracy, which I think is one of Mises' underappreciated books. It's short, it's easy to read, it's very clear, and it gives a great statement of the socialist calculation problem. So if you've never read Bureaucracy, I would highly recommend it. It's not just about corporate bureaucracy or whatever. It's really about differences between market and non-market behavior. And I think Mises does a very good job there. Essentially, Mises' argument is that non-market organizations, while completely legitimate, right? And Mises was no anarcho-capitalist. Mises thought that government organizations in their proper sphere were completely legitimate, as charities and churches and nonprofits and so on would be completely legitimate. But Mises says non-market or nonprofit institutions have to be managed in a different way from market or for-profit kinds of institutions. And the reason is that for-profit organizations ultimately have a clear and unambiguous measure of performance. Profit, right? There's money profit and money loss. There's the income statement. There's the bottom line. So while entrepreneurs can experiment with different management styles, they can experiment with different business strategies, different resource combinations and so on, but they get good feedback from the market about whether their experiments, whether they've done the right thing or not. You make money or you lose money. And if you're successful, you consistently make money over time, you're able to attract or accumulate more capital, expand your activities, et cetera, et cetera. If you're unsuccessful, you lose money, and eventually your capital is depleted, and you can't be an entrepreneur anymore. What happens if you're not a market entity? Well, non-market entities, in some cases, do have to compete with each other for resources, right? The Mises Institute competes with other nonprofit 501c3 organizations for financial support or contributions. Though, of course, there really is no competition. I want to make that clear. The Red Cross competes for your time and your donations and your money. Churches compete for tithes and so on. But those organizations, their objectives are not necessarily measurable in terms of money. It's, how many souls are saved, or how many people in the community are ministered to, or it's how successful are we at spreading ideas about Austrian economics throughout the wider society. Well, I mean, the top brass of the Mises Institute spend a lot of time trying to assess, how the organization is doing, what activities should it be doing, should it be having more conferences or fewer conferences, more online courses or fewer, should the website be expanded in this way or that way. I mean, these are all business decisions that have to be made, but it's particularly challenging in a nonprofit because you don't always know if you've done it right. You don't have good data on outcomes. Therefore, according to Mises, the owners, the governing board, the central management of nonprofit organizations needs to exercise a little bit of tighter control and delegate less authority to subordinates than is possible in a for-profit setting. Right, in a for-profit company, the CEO, the board of directors, the central management can say to people who are farther down the line of command, look, you have the expertise in your particular business, you have the specialized knowledge, the tacit knowledge, you decide what's the best marketing strategy. You decide whether to produce more of this particular product or that. You decide if you want to manage your activities this way or that, and we will judge you based on the contribution of your activities to the bottom line. We don't need to tell you what to do. We don't need to give you detailed chapter and verse. We can let you make your own decisions, but we're going to judge you based on results. And we have a good way to do that because we have the bottom line. Mises points out that you can't operate an army unit or a police department in that same decentralized management style. Right, you can't say to patrol officers, look, you decide who you want to arrest and what's the best way to patrol the streets. We'll judge you based on what would the performance measure be? Arrests per day. You can see some problems there, right? How many little old ladies are helped across the street? Possibly, incentive and measurement problems there, right? With the Red Cross, is it, amount of blood collected? Is it amount of blood delivered? Is it number of, earthquake victims helped? I mean, how do you measure performance of an individual in the organization or a subunit within the organization to know whether to reward or not to reward? You just can't do it, right? So Mises argues that nonprofit organizations, while perfectly legitimate, need to be managed in a more centralized fashion. And you want to limit the scope of their activities because that more centralized management style can run into problems, right? Can steer things in the wrong direction, okay? Other comments or questions about anything at all whatsoever? Anything else, guys? Don't be shy. I know you have lots more tough ones inside of you. Anything, guys? Okay, well, we can certainly, it's 10:28, so we can... We can knock off on those. Okay, yeah, Maggie's asking about some forum questions. I haven't had a chance to answer them on the forum. You want me to talk about them now? Let me pull up those threads. Just a second, guys. Right, Maggie, tell me which questions in particular you are most interested in discussing. You know, I don't mind talking about them now. I guess I probably should write out my answer. Well, I tell you what, why don't I just do the answers in writing because that way more people can see them because there are only a few of us who are live right now and other people may not listen to the recording all the way to the end, but they will be more likely to see it on the forums. Why don't I just do it on the forum? Anyway, okay, well, great to talk to you guys this morning. Keep those questions coming. Keep the discussion going. Danny and I will be working diligently to have another little quiz ready for you this afternoon, and we will meet up again next week for our regular lecture. And next week we get to talk about the internet specifically, its history and origins, which I think are very interesting, and maybe challenge the conventional wisdom both on the kind of Al Gore side and on the libertarian utopia side about the nature and characteristics of the internet. So anyway, have a great weekend, everybody. Hope you warm up if you're in a cold spot, and I will talk to you soon.